So tonight, like I said, is March 1st. It's our last class on Hasidic Insights on the Parsha. This week's Parsha is Parsha Tetzaveh, which is the second Parsha that deals with the Mishkan, the building of the Tabernacle. And it just so happens that two of the little drashot, the sermonettes of the Me'ah Shiloh on this week's Parsha, are a continuation of the same subject we began last week, and I chose those two so we can round out what we talked about last time, and a lot of the discussion we had in the give and take last time, you'll see how it's reflected and developed in what we're going to see today. Now, in order to do this properly, we have to remember what we did last time. Some of you were here, some of you weren't. I'm going to review, and I hope the review will be helpful. We saw last time three Hasidic texts. The first was from the early period of Hasidut. The text was called Kedushat HaLevi, which literally means the holiness of the Levi, written by Rabbi Levi Yitzhak Miberdachev. And he contrasted between two different expressions that are found in the Tanakh and in our prayers. One expression talks about God as the being that bore, who creates, and the other expression talked about God as the being that bara, that created. The present as opposed to the past tense. And he explained that there's a very important theological difference between these two different ways of relating to God. When I relate to God as bara, as he who created the universe in the past tense, I'm basically putting forward a theological model that can be described by the word that he doesn't use, but I'm going to use, transcendental. God is transcendental. He uses the word separate, that when I relate to God as bara, it means that I am seeing myself and human beings as separate from God. God is over there, he's far away, he's distant, he did what he did, he stopped doing it, and now it's us that are doing whatever is done in this world. God is a bara as opposed to a bore. And on the other hand, when I relate to God as bore, as the creator who's still creating, well, then I'm not looking at myself as a private individual, separate identity, but I'm now actually the emanation from God. God is emanating the world and emanating me and in charge constantly. That model that God is in charge and involved and actually here and he is flowing through all of us, that is not a model of God's transcendence, it's a model of God's immanence. And I wrote here, I don't think I did this last time, I talk about my concentric circles, this time I actually drew them. The model on the right, on my right, is a model of transcendence. Let's say that God is this big circle, and the world is a little circle, and the point is they're two separate circles. There was once a connection when God was bore, but now it's past, God is bara, he has created, and the world has a certain separateness, a distinctiveness, an independence to a certain degree. On the other hand, on the left-hand side is a model of what you can call immanence. And the particular way I drew it, there are different models of immanence. Immanence means connection. The big circle is God, and the world is within, which means God is much more than the world, but all the world is suffused with God. And if the big circle were to disappear, the little circle could not exist anymore, it wouldn't have any space to be. God is the space of the world. That's a model of immanence, and the particular theological model I drew here is called panentheism. Pantheism is God is the world, and the world is God, there's a complete overlap between them, and there's no difference. Whereas panentheism says the God is much bigger than the world, but the world is God, the world is God, but God isn't the world. As God is has the world in him, and the world is all God, but God is also much more than that. The Rabbi Levi Yitzhak Miberdachev seemed to imply that the model of panentheism, of immanence, is the preferred model, although he did talk about what he calls, and this is Kabbalistic language, of retso v'sho, which means back and forth, that we alternate in our consciousness between these two different ways of relating to God. I'll add one more matter. The model of transcendence is, that's a theological word. On a psychological level, the word to use is awe. Two separate bodies, God and man. We look at God who's beyond, totally other, totally grand, totally majestic, and we're in awe of that greatness. And awe creates a sense and a need of obedience, of bending your stature to the great God. Whereas, on the left-hand side, is a model of panentheism, immanence, when everything in the world is God, and therefore there's no matter of awe of the God who is other, but rather it's God who's inside, that engenders more than awe, engenders love and identification and connection. Okay. That was Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Miberdachev. Then we went on to a second thinker. This thinker is the Beis Yaakov, in Sephardi Hebrew, the Beit Yaakov. And he is the son of the Izbitcher, that is to say of the Mehashiloach. We're talking about now the very, very end of the 19th century in Poland. This is the father. We learned the son, the Beis Yaakov. And he has there a beautiful image that I'm sure everyone who was here last week remembers. Remember images, right? Not just ideas. And the image was the meaning behind the choreography of the beginning of the Shmona Asrei, of the silent prayer, in which we say at the very beginning, Baruch, and we bend our knees. How can I do that with my arms? I can't, right? We bend our knees, we go down. Then we say Atah, we bow. And then when we say Hashem, the third word, God's name, we stand up straight. So the Beis Yaakov said that when you bend and bow and you show subservience and obedience and acceptance of the yoke of God by bowing your body, which symbolizes bowing your will, that is a model of transcendence. Because God is other and you're giving, not a good way to say it, you are bending, right? You are retreating in the face of the all-powerful, the distant, and the other God. That's Baruch Atah. But when you stand up straight and say Hashem, what you've done is you've moved from the model of transcendence to the model of immanence, and you now say, I can stand up straight. I don't have to bow and bend my will in the face of God's will, because God's will is not outside of me to be bent to. It's within me, and I identify with it. I don't bend to it, but it's me. And therefore, I can stand up straight with a certain degree of independence. And therefore, we talked about the paradox here of the relationship between theology and psychology. The paradox is as follows, that when I think of God as closer and part of what's going on, and that everything is ruled by God, that paradoxically creates human empowerment. Not human servitude, human empowerment. The servitude is when I think of God as being outside me, as a king, a commander. But when I think of God inside of me, that means that I have this divine power inside of me that's part of me, that identify with me. I don't have to bend my will to God, but my will is God, and God is my will, and that creates human uprightness. What's a good word for that? Human self-sufficiency, human self-confidence. The belief in God, the faith in God, creates faith in man. Creativity. That's the second source we saw last week. And the third source, if you want to comment, please do, because there might be things I forgot, things you want to add. The third source, in our review, we saw the Mishiloch himself. And he tied all of this into last week's Torah portion. The beginning of last week's Torah portion, as you remember, talks about the contributions of the gold and the silver and the beautiful tapestries and linen for the tabernacle. Make a contribution to God, it said at the very beginning. You build the tabernacle. And the Meir Shiloach said, in typical Hasidic fashion, that the verses have nothing to do with what you thought they have to do with. It's not about contributing your gold and silver to the tabernacle, even though that's what it is about, but it's not. It's really about, on the metaphorical level, it's about contributing the gold and silver within you to God, to God's tabernacle. Giving of yourself to God such that you undergo a transformation of consciousness and you see yourself now as part of God, because you've given yourself over to God and God rules me. That's this. That's the model of Hashem, that I stand up tall because I'm a tool of God. I'm not a servant of God, but I'm actually in God's hand. It's not that I have to bend my will to God, but my will is God's will because we have, as it were, become one. And he talks there explicitly. He says explicitly, you should not be in awe of God. That sounds kind of sacrilegious. Shouldn't be in awe of God. But you should rather be in love with God, to the God within you. And as I mentioned last time, with this we'll end our review, that in a certain sense, what the Me'e Shiloach is doing is a kind of veiled, moderated polemic against what today is called ultra-orthodoxy. Because how do you say in Hebrew, ultra-orthodox? Anyone remember?
Haredi.
Or Haredi, which means God-fearer. Haredi means trembling and fearful of God. Now, of course, you should be in fear of God. You should be obedient to God. But the Me'e Shiloach is afraid that a stance that is exclusively made up of fear and awe of God paralyzes human beings. And you lose creativity. You lose vitality. You lose life. You lose self-confidence. And he tells us, move from the model of transcendence, fear, awe, to the model of give yourself over to God. Not in the sense of bending to his will, but absorbing it inside. You're a part of God. And he says that creates human beings, or should create human beings, of joy and self-confidence. That's the summary from last time.
Wow. If you don't have awe for God, then the word awe shouldn't be in the dictionary. Then who would you have awe for?
Your mother.
Oh.
And I was serious. Right, there's a mitzvah to have awe of your parents.
But if we don't say awe, we say honor.
That's a different mitzvah. Right, there's two mitzvot. There's a mitzvah kibud horim, to honor your parents. There's a mitzvah lira. There really is a mitzvah to fear, or awe is a better word, have awe of your parents. Now, of course, it's also true, the Torah does also say to have love for God and also to have fear for God. Fear, awe, and the same thing in Hebrew. Yeah. But the Me'e Shiloach is emphasizing that there's something very problematic in a relationship that's only based on awe vis-a-vis God.
The Me'e Shiloach wrote during the 19th century?
He's at the 1860s, 70s, 80s in Poland.
Because I was thinking of Soloveitchik's book, Halachic Man, which I guess was written quite a lot later, am I correct?
Yes.
And he talks about the majestic person and the humble...
Right. Adam 1 and Adam 2.
Yeah,
right.
And saying that this is what it means to be a Jew.
The isolation.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
He surely read that.
Well... Well,
we don't know.
First of all, Karen's point is very well taken. Rabbi Soloveitchik certainly works on the same
division.
Continuum,
yeah,
that we talked about right now. But Rabbi Soloveitchik really sees the ideal in the balancing of the two, whereas we're about to see today, indeed, the Me'e Shiloach doesn't see it so much as a balancing act, but as a progression. The progression is towards love and identification and away from fear.
Okay.
Right. Which is, in a certain sense, you could say, more radical or more modern, in a certain sense. So again, the Me'e Shiloach, just like we saw in his son, the Baruch Atah Hashem, it's a progression towards this pan-entheistic understanding and away from this transcendent understanding. And as Kabbalists, Hasidim, they are partial towards the more pan-entheistic understanding, whereas Rabbi Soloveitchik, as a rational Litvak, is much more partial, actually, to the transcendent understanding.
Litvak
Litvak.
Litvak.
Depends where you come from in Lithuania.
If in a
I'm not, what can I do? But she's right. No, my father has very little knowledge of his forebears in Eastern Europe and not a lot of knowledge of Judaism, but when he goes on Friday, if I ask him to buy, and I won't say what it's called, for the Shabbat bread, and you see how he pronounces it, then you can see where he's from in Eastern Europe. It's Chali.
Where's that? Chali.
Oh, my father's from Pittsburgh, you're telling me.
This is Yom Kippur.
Yeah. Well, that means they all came from the same place in Eastern Europe.
Where is that?
I was afraid you can ask me, I've forgotten. I know it's a certain place, I can't remember where it is. Certain area. Okay, so now we're going to go into this week's studies, which is a continuation of last week. We said, so we're going to open up the Chumash.
My father had the same accent.
So this week's Torah portion is Parshat Tetzaveh in the book of Exodus. It is chapter 28. And we read at the beginning of chapter 28, Parshat Tetzaveh. The Parsha begins two or three verses before that. We're beginning with the beginning of chapter 28. Anyone has the page can tell us what page it's on.
Number 4.
First verse of 28. What page?
504.
You shall bring forward your brother Aharon with his sons from among the Israelites to serve me as priests, as Kohanim. Aharon, Nadav, Avihu, Itamar, Eleazar, the sons of Aharon. Make sacral vestments for your brother Aharon for dignity and adornment. Next, you'd instruct all our skillful whom are endowed with the gift of skill to make Aaron's vestments for consecrating him to serve me as priest. These are the vestments they are to make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a fringed tunic, a headdress, and a sash. I counted 6. The problem is that when you go through all the verses that talk about the weaving and the making of the vestments of the priests, there's 8 and not 6. And the question is, why does the opening verse mention 6 and doesn't mention the other 2? Let's read through a little bit. You look at the beginning of verse 6. They shall make an ephod. Okay, there's the ephod. And then it says in verse 15, you shall make a breastplate. Okay, there's the breastplate. And if you go through verse 31, you shall make the robe of the ephod. And then verse 39, and then verse 36 says, you shall make a frontlet of pure gold. That wasn't in the list. The frontlet is in Hebrew the tzitz. It's the gold plate that's on the it's called the turban. The turban's on his head, and then on the turban they put the gold plate that says on it, holy to God. The gold plate wasn't mentioned earlier in the list. And it goes back and gives the making of all the piece of clothing in the list. But why is the frontlet, the tzitz, not in the original list? Something else that's not in the original list that is mentioned later is the pants. There's no pants. How do they call them in Hebrew, in English? Breeches. Breeches in verse 42. So there's 8 garments, the 6 mentioned at the beginning, and then the pants and the tzitz, the frontlet. And the question that many commentators talk about, and this is the one that the Meshulok will focus on, is why are the tzitz and the pants not mentioned in the opening list? We're going to focus more on the tzitz than on the pants. So with that, we move to the Meshulok. I'm not going to read the whole Hebrew. I'm not going to read the whole English. Just little pieces. And some of you have a copy in which I put little brackets in the English there on the left-hand side. Do you have a copy?
No.
So I only made 8, so we'll have to share.
Here. Here.
Okay, so now you'll be able to see. Okay, and Dan can see, right? Everyone can see. So I'm reading the English of the Meir Shiloach on the sheet that you have in your hands. The first sheet. And I'm reading from the third line. The tzitz hints that he is constantly cleaving to the blessed God as he is commanded always to wear it on his forehead. So you can understand that it symbolizes having God really close to you, always cleaving to God. Engraved on the tzitz were the words Kodesh Lashem, holy unto God, meaning that the words from Divrei Hayamim, which is Chronicles, know the God of your father and serve him, were constantly in the depth of his thought. Okay. We're going to skip three or four lines to my next bracket. The robe, mi'il, and that's one of the six that was mentioned in the first list. The tzitz wasn't, but the mi'il was. The mi'il teaches of his great fear of God. For it was made entirely of techelet, which hints at fear. So you know the techelet color, the Torah says, put in the tzitzit, is what's left of mine, right? It's getting pretty old. And I was arguing over this with Earl by email, over the color of it. Right? Earl claimed that it's supposed to be sky blue, a light blue.
I'll note that's what it says.
That's
here.
What it says here. And I was claiming that it's royal blue. Indeed, if you notice in the flag of Israel, it's white and blue. The blue is techelet, and it's light blue, like Earl said. But that was done over 70 years ago. What I had said to Earl, and I think that I'm right, I'm not 100% sure, that I have friends in Israel who have actually been involved in the reintroduction of techelet to Jewish life. What happened is, to make a long story short, is that we know from the time of the Mishnah, year 200 of the Common and before, that they wore techelet, as the Torah says, in the tzitzit, it was made from the blood of a snail.
Right.
A snail, it's the Murus truncolus in, is that Latin? Latin?
What is H-Y-S-S-O-P?
Hey, hi. Hyssop, that's a plant.
That's where it's supposed to come from.
No! No!
It's a snail.
Absolutely not.
It's a mollusk. Or a snail.
It's a mollusk.
Yeah.
The reason I'm saying that is not because I'm smart enough to know that. I just finished reading The Dove Keepers.
It's a book.
It's a book.
Yeah, I've read it.
It's about Masada. You know, like The Red Tent was novelized for us. Mm-hmm. That's The Dove Keepers of Masada. Mm-hmm. And they talk about this plant. But I don't know how to pronounce it. H-Y-S-S-O-P.
Yeah.
If they would get the blue for the tzitzit.
No.
Okay.
The author got it really wrong.
I'm going to write to the author. And
right.
Somebody goofed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the snail that provides the raw material for the making of the techelet, its habitat is in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. When in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, the Jewish people started moving away from the Mediterranean basin and into Babylonia and the whole Middle East and, of course, to Italy and then up to Germany and France, we gradually lost connection to the habitat of this snail and we no longer made techelet. That's why the tzitzit, you know, today, from about the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries until today, are just with white.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did we lose the connection, we also lost the formula of how to make the dye. And then in the end of the 19th century, there were stirrings of studies trying to figure out how to do this. And there were a lot of false starts and a lot of misunderstanding and different opinions of what was the animal it came from. And it wasn't until the doctorate of the first chief rabbi of Israel, of the state of Israel, not the pre-state, Rabbi Herzog, who actually was from Ireland, and he did his doctorate, I think it's at Cambridge, before he made the Aliyah on the Techelet. And his assumptions were, his hypothesis later was proven that it's from this snail. So then in the 1980s, they began the efforts to try actually to put this into practice and to extract the dye from the snail, and it wasn't easy to make a color. At the very beginning, the color came out lighter than it did as the years went by, and they learned how to better oxidize the dye, and it turned into a very, very bright blue. In other words, our understanding of what the color is has changed over the years. And in any case, I believe, that it really is what we call royal blue, and the reason it's called royal blue is this is the color that the royalty wore in the Middle East 2,000 and 3,000 years ago. And the use of it in tzitzit is a transference It's the royal color, and it's used in the royal priesthood as a word. By rule, I mean elevated. How did we get to that? So anyway, so because we're reading here that the robe is made completely of tefillah, and it hints at fear. The reason it hints at fear, the Gemara says this, and now you're going to tell me that I'm unfortunately contradicting everything I said. But I'll just tell you the truth. The Gemara says that Techelet reminds you of the sea, the color of the sea. Mm-hmm. And the color of the sea reminds you of the color of the sky. And the sky reminds you of God, and that brings you to fear. It's a long train there. But it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. The idea is that Techelet, the robe, one of the six vestments mentioned at the opening of the parsha, is supposed to represent and remind us of fear of God. That's all. We go on. Why were the pants and the tzitz not mentioned when the garments are enumerated in verse 4? Right? And then he gives a reason why the pants weren't mentioned. That's not important for us. I'm skipping 2.5 lines. The tzitz was not mentioned, as it is explained in the Zohar, the famous magnum opus of Jewish mysticism, the mitzcha of God's desire is revealed at the mincha prayer of Shabbat. Now, what does that mean? We have no idea. But the word, he puts it in brackets here, mitzcha. It says the mitzcha of God's desire, and mitzcha is forehead. Forehead reminds us of the tzitz that's on the forehead. So it's saying something about the forehead of God's desire is revealed at the mincha afternoon prayer of Shabbat. What's that talking about? He doesn't explain to the very end. We'll just read on. The tzitz was given to Aharon, HaKohen, since he had great fear of God. For all the tribe of Levi possessed great fear, as is written, I gave him fear, to the priests. And of course, Levi is the priest, is the Kohen. It's all about fear. And all the more so the high priest, he's the highest of the high, he's the highest of the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi is about fear of God, so he's symbolic of fear of God. He's an embodiment of fear of God. Even his very name teaches the fear of God. For Aaron is the numerical equivalent, that's gematria, right? Every Hebrew letter has a numerical value. The gematria of Aaron, Aleph, Hey, Resh, Vav, Nun, is 256, corresponding to 256 of the wings of the angels called Chayot HaKadoshim. And wings teach fear. Now, why do wings teach fear? Again, it's a long shot. If you go into Ezekiel's vision of the charity of God, and I'm sure you spend every day there, right? The mystical vision, the creatures of God, they have wings. With two of the wings they fly, and with two of them they cover their faces. So the wings symbolizes fear. Why do they cover their faces? Fear of God. They don't want to see God. So wings symbolize fear. And again, gematria brings us from wings to Aaron, so Aaron symbolizes fear. The way we get there, you know, this is chassidut, we've said this in the past, it's not the pshat. But the idea he wants to tell us is that Aaron is a man who embodies fear of God. And that's why the tzitz was given to Aaron. Now, we didn't explain what's the connection. And I won't explain yet. I'll just read more. Corresponding to this great fear, he was given the tzitz to vivify and delight his soul. For the tzitz teaches of the love that the blessed God has for Israel, and I believe that I would call that a mistranslation. I'm going to look at the Hebrew. No, it's not a mistranslation. But still, I'll explain. What he is saying is that Aaron, because he's a man of fear of God, needs the tzitz to counter his natural disposition. Remember we read above that the tzitz, I'm in the third, fourth, and fifth lines, is about cleaving to God. Cleaving to God is the opposite of fear of God. Fear of God is when you retreat, you surrender, you run away, and you cower in the distance, and you Express servitude, but not clinging. Clinging is dvekut, is unity, is togetherness, is love, identification. The idea is that the tzitz is a necessary counterweight to the natural religious disposition of our own that has to be balanced. And that's going to explain why the tzitz wasn't mentioned in the opening list. We'll read it right now. The tzitz had to wait for later. Why did it have to wait for later? And we're going to read on. Then at the time when the blessed God revealed his great love, that's the tzitz, the unity of God and man, all the fears depart. It counters, it outweighs, it balances out the fear of God, and Israel experiences great empowerment. Empowerment, right? That is self-confidence. And that brings us back to the word at the end of the first line of the second paragraph, vivify. Vivify brings light, life. In other words, you need the tzitz, you need the love, you need the cling to God to counterbalance the fear and therefore to create vivification and empowerment. In other words, to release the Kohen from the quote-unquote shackles of fear. To release him, to empower him, to liberate him, to cling to God, and to create that creative self-confidence. Therefore, before the making of the robe was mentioned, it was not possible to mention the making of the tzitz. That is the progression of religious life. You have to have the me'il, symbolizing fear, before you can get to the tzitz, symbolizing love. So it is a progression, and we do give more weight to the love than the fear, but it has to come at its proper time. And I'm pretty sure someone actually, it was Celia, actually brought this up last week. If you don't remember, but I think that you talked about the fact that you can't just begin with love of God. I think you said it.
No.
Okay? And someone else said it. Right? So, as opposed to Rav Soloveitchik, who always wants us to oscillate, the Mishloch is talking about moving from one to the other, but you can't move from one to the other until you have the first so you can move to the second. Why do you have to begin with fear of God? Why? Why? I'll read the sentence again. Therefore, before the making of the robe was mentioned, that's the fear, it was not possible to mention the making of the tzitz, for the great profusion of empowerment could, God forbid, bring forth an irreverent spirit. A reverent spirit is a pretty good translation. The Hebrew is kalut rosh, lightness of head, lightness of stance, of character. Right? Because love of God that is not based upon fear of God is very dangerous. Because it can create haughtiness that I'm God, everything inside me is good, so I can do whatever I want. Right? That actually, in a certain sense, was the great problematic of one of the most famous false messiahs in Jewish history, Shabtai Tzvi. He had a sense that he was God, and therefore I can do whatever I want. Don't have to follow any laws. In the end, he converted to Islam and still said he's the Messiah. So there's a great problematic in the theology of love of God, of clinging to God, the philosophy, again, of panentheism, and the way for the Meshiloach to counter and balance that danger is to build upon a foundation of awe and love of God, but to move in the proper direction. And that's why the tzitz could not have been mentioned in the first list. The first list had to be about the techelet of the me'il, of the fear, and then only later can build upon it. Therefore, I'll just finish it off. Therefore, after the making of the meal, which teaches a fear, was mentioned, it was then possible to mention the making of the tzitz, as in the words of the Holy Zohar. Now he goes back to the Zohar that we didn't understand to begin with. He's explaining how he understands it, why it was brought. At the time of Minchav Shabbat, which is after great fear, the brilliance of his desire is revealed, meaning great empowerment. In other words, we should look at Shabbat as a 25-hour period of progression, of spiritual progression. Now, let me say in this context that we know that of the three prayer services of every day, the first one at night, Ma'ariv, and then the morning Shachrit, and then the afternoon Mincha, that's the way we make the progression from night to morning to afternoon, the Shmon Asrei, the Amidah, the silent prayer, is the same text for all three of them on a weekday, but not on Shabbat. On Shabbat, the essence of the Shmon Asrei changes. It's one thing Friday night, it's another thing Shabbat morning, it's another thing in the afternoon, another thing at Mincha. And if you look at the words that change, so you see that the emphasis of the prayer at Mincha is unity. Unity of the Jewish people and God. It says everything is one. Right. Everything is one. So that progression towards oneness, is what the Mir Shloka is talking about. That when we get to Shabbat Mincha, that's when we can put aside fear of God and come to the yearning for the unity with God. And that's what the Zohar says in his interpretation. That the brilliance of his desire, and again in Hebrew that was mitzcha, forehead, which refers to the tzitz, which was the clinging to God, that has its place specifically at Mincha and Shabbat and not before that. Only at the end of Shabbat, which perhaps also can be understood to talk about the second part of life. It's only when you get older that you are allowed, you have permission to begin to try to experience unity with God. It takes years of first building upon a basis, a foundation of distance and transcendence and awe and subservience, and you can gradually, slowly morph into ahava, to love and clinging and unity and empowerment and creativity only later in life of Shabbat, later in your own life, later in the spiritual progression.
I don't know if this has any relevance, but what I'm thinking about is Maslow and his theory of self-actualization. You know, you have to start off at the basic needs. If you don't have those met, you really can't move up. But as you're moving on kind of up to his hierarchical levels, you get to the point where I would equate the self-actualization to being the epitome of self-confidence and the love of God.
Right.
Pretty good analogy.
Yeah, at the top there, I think you're right. But Maslow's lower stages are not the same as our lower stages here.
No.
But right, that's very good. That's very good. Right? It's about building the personality step by step. Yeah.
When we came in this evening, I was trying in my feeble, inadequate way to explain the significance of a kippah. And I was wondering if you could say how that relates to this, to my understanding of the sense of humility or fear or separation.
A kippah has become, everything you said is right, the kippah has become a pretty central symbol of Jews, but the truth is, in Jewish law and theology, it's pretty minor, mm-hmm. Right? There's no mention of a kippah in the Torah, there's no mention of a kippah in the Tanakh, there's no mention of a kippah in the Mishnah. You get to the Talmud, there's a mention of the fact that very righteous men should cover their heads. It doesn't say everyone. Not at all. And even at the beginning of the Middle Ages, not all Jews covered their heads. It's really quite a late development. If you look from a completely legal standpoint, the tzitzit are much, much more central than the kippah. But in modern Jewish life, it's got turned around.
Cultural thing.
Yeah, yeah. So therefore, I don't want to make a big deal of the kippah. But if you asked, the Gemara says one line. The Gemara says, remind you there's something above you. And it really is there for the symbol more of awe than it is of love. Right. And of separation.
And there's no... symbolic aspect to, at least, I mean, this is something that's attributed to our own as a priest. I mean, this wasn't something that was shared by common people. So are we not to participate in that, the love aspect, or not even aspire to it?
No, I think we are. No, I think we are. This is certainly a model for all Jews, as long as we take it step by step and don't rush into the love before we go through the earlier stages. No, but it certainly is a model for all Jews who are worthy.
If you're going to talk about it in the next session, then don't talk about it tonight. But is this, what you're talking about here, going to be part of the discussion in the next 10 sessions?
Seal, I think, brought that up last week. There is a connection.
Well, certainly the part about the fear and the love part that you're talking about right now. To me, if you're saying, especially following this bigger circle of the little tiny one, okay, I don't see Christianity following this one on the left at all.
Which is the left?
That left. They're on the right.
I actually mean to say the opposite.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
In other words, what I'll say another 2 weeks is more or less something like this, that the more foundational and mainstream Jewish philosophy is this one. The Hasidic stuff is really not mainstream. And Christianity, as far as I understand, really takes the love stuff even further than Hasidut does.
Yeah, but they sure talk a lot about the fear.
I think they take both. They take the fear if, in their theology and words, God is someone to be feared if you do not have a personal relationship with Jesus, with God and Jesus. But if you do, then Jesus is in you, and therefore what you're doing is Jesus working through you. So
in you,
if you go feed
you,
the poor,
here,
it's really God feeding the poor through you. So, because he's inside you.
Yeah. So.
What did you say? You mumbled. So
now,
they have both, I think.
Now what we're going to do, and we're going to do this in less than 10 minutes, we'll see another piece of the Me'ah Shiloach on this week's parsha that uses a different set of symbols to say the same thing. It's not new ideas. We can do it quickly before we go on to the last 20 minutes of our class today. So, we're turning the next page in the packet. I guess it's the back what you have. And you can see that he quotes a verse from Shmot chapter 30, and you shall make an altar to burn the incense, make it of acacia wood. So concerning that one verse, we're going to now go back to the Chumash and talk about that one verse. And the way we'll do it is turning back to the beginning of Parshat Truma. Parshat Truma is chapter 24. No, 25. Chapter 25. Anyone who finds the page, please tell everyone.
485.
Oh. Okay. And we're going to flip through a number of verses very quickly. So look at chapter 25, verse 10. 25:10. They shall make an ark of acacia wood. Okay. After looking at that, look at verse 23. You shall make a table of acacia wood. Okay. Then look at verse 31. 31. You shall make a lampstand of pure gold. That's a menorah. Right? And then look at chapter 26, the first verse. As for the tabernacle, make it of 10 strips of cloth. And then look at verse 15 of chapter 26. 26:15. You shall make the planks for the tabernacle. Okay. And then you can go on to verse 31. You shall make a curtain of blue, purple, and crimson yarns. What did we just see? We saw the instructions to make the furniture that's inside the tabernacle. We saw the ark, we saw the table, and we saw the candelabra, the lampstand. And then we had the instructions to make the building, the planks and the curtains. And then in chapter 27, you shall make the altar of acacia wood. That's the altar for burnt offerings. It's in the courtyard outside the tabernacle. So it's very clear the way it's structured, from building the ark that's really inside the Holy of Holies to building the furniture that's in the holy, the next cubicle, and then the building, and then the altar that's outside the building.
Now, what is acacia wood?
Don't ask me. It's wood from an acacia tree.
that makes sense. Okay, whatever. Yeah.
In Hebrew, it's atzei shittim. It's wood. So,
I thought it was very durable wood, or
I don't know. I'm not practical. I'm a philosopher. I'm a theologian.
It's not a carpenter.
So,
if you ever find an acacia tree, let me know. We'll market it. We'll both be rich.
We'll go down to Israel to find it.
And after all this, it goes to this week's parsha, Parsha Tetzaveh, and we saw that that's about the vestments of the high priest. So it goes from the furniture that's inside the building, to the altar that's outside the building, and then to the vestments of the high priest through Parsha Tetzaveh, this week's parsha. And then look at chapter 30. After all that's finished, and it's said to make the whole structure, and all the vestments, we finally get to chapter 30 of Exodus. What page is that on?
517.
You shall make an altar for burning incense. What did you wait until now to tell me the altar of incense? The altar of incense is inside the holy. It's completely out of place. That's the issue that the Mishloach is going to deal with. Why isn't the altar of burning incense mentioned where the other two vessels that are inside the tabernacle are mentioned, the table and the candelabra? Why did it wait until now? And you can see that's the same type of question we asked half an hour ago about the seats. Why was the seats not mentioned at the beginning, but it waited till after? Same thing now. Why is the altar of burning incense mentioned only after? That's the question. So we'll read the Mishloach pretty quickly. All the vessels were mentioned in Parshat Truma except for the golden incense altar. This can be understood through what is written in the Holy Zohar. What is incense? It's the connection of all. You see, incense is ketoret in Hebrew. Let me just write that for you. Is ketoret. That word means incense, but if you take the same letters kuf, tet, resh, as if they were Aramaic,
Keter, Katar,
which in Aramaic means a knot, a connection, and therefore the Hasidic homily is that ketoret, incense, is about connection between man and God. You can also see the symbolism in the smoke going from heaven. I'm sorry, from earth. To heaven, again symbolizing connection. What does connection symbolize theologically? It symbolizes the immanence, the panentheism. So he says, this hints that all done, even this world, is all connected in the will of the blessed God. Without his will, nothing at all would be done. It's everything's infused with God. God is inside me. It's always God's will that is active. Of course, this comes close to denying free will, but that's another can of kosher worms. One who misunderstands this could come to irreverence. Right? Because if you understand that God is inside you and everything you do is God's will, well then everything I do is God's will, so I can do whatever I want. I can murder and it's God's will. And it leads to irreverence, again, to kalut rosh, to a lightness, not taking responsibility for your actions. God forbid. Since you say everything that happens is allowed to happen from heaven. Therefore, the incense altar, which represents this understanding of connection, that's all God, it's all connected, panentheism, immanence. Therefore, the incense altar, which represents this understanding, was not set in Parshat Truma, but only after The explanations of the priestly garments in this parsha, which teach of the great fear of God and vigilance guarding from the vain pleasures of this world. See, it's the same explanation he gave for why the seats had to wait after all the garments, because it symbolizes love and connection, and that's dangerous without a foundation. The same thing with the incense, so had to wait to the end after everything else was finished, after we establish a foundation of fear and awe, then we can get to the ideas of imminence and it's all God, and empowerment and it's all God's will and it's all connected. That's enough. I'll just read the last line of the paragraph. Then after the Kohen has instilled such fear in the heart of Israel, then they have the ability afterwards to receive the simcha, the joy and the love that comes from the power of the incense. It's about, again, the spiritual progression, everything in its proper time. That's nothing new, just another symbol to remember it, to concretize it. And now what we're going to do, as our finale for this trimester, is see how Rav Kook takes these ideas and translates them into a modern idiom. And I know everyone likes Rav Kook. We did this like 2 years ago. We probably didn't see the essay we're about to see. But here is, to me, another indication of how Rav Kook is deeply indebted to Hasidut, and especially to the Meir Shiloach, but different language, the same ideas in different language and different application. So here we go. This is from the same set of essays that we saw 2 years ago, from the same book and from the same chapters in the book. It's an essay called A Thirst for the Living God, Simaon Le'el Chai. Ready? Ready. The spirit cannot find stability except in a life oriented toward God. Knowledge, feeling, the imagination, and the will, in their inner and outer manifestations, all condition people to center their lives in God. Then will they be able to find their fulfillment, their equitable and satisfying state. If a person should seek for himself less than this exalted state, he will at once become like a ship tossed about at sea. Stormy waves raging in opposite directions will continually rob him of peace. He will be thrown from wave to wave and he will be unable to find himself. If he should be able to immerse himself in some crude and vulgar preoccupation, he may succeed for a time in reducing the perspective of his life, and it will seem to him that he has finally found peace. But it will not take long, and the spirit will break out of its imprisonment, and the maddening agitation will begin to act in all its fury. Let's not analyze that too much. We'll really understand what he's saying in context as we read more. But more or less he's saying that you need God to have a good life. You need God to have a stable, satisfying life. And if you don't have God, you're lost, and you could cling to something for a few days or weeks or months or years, but eventually you'll see that the preoccupations of the physical, material world, they don't really provide you with an anchor. But I don't want to say more about that. I have to wait. The place where we may find peace is only in God. That continues the previous paragraph. God, however, transcends, and we recognize that as a key word, transcends. God transcends the existing world, making it impossible for us to grasp any aspect of him in feeling or thought. He's totally beyond, totally other. Can't understand anything about God. He's beyond. This makes him, as far as we are concerned, non-existent. He's so far away that his reality is not connected to us at all, as if there isn't a God, God forbid. And the spirit cannot find contentment in what that doesn't exist. It is for this reason that wise men who devote themselves to the quest for God are, for the most part, spiritually weary. They're searching for sentiments too far away to find. When the soul aspires to the most luminous light, it cannot be content with that light which shines in the quality of justice and the best of good deeds, or in the measure of truth and the most precise body of knowledge, and the attribute of beauty and the most exalted of visions. In other words, sometimes We can't find God, so we take social justice as a replacement. That's what he's saying. But it doesn't help. It satisfies us for the short while, but it's not what we're looking for. We search for justice, we search for truth, we search for social justice, we search for aesthetics. It satisfies only for a small amount of time. Because it's not God. It then sees the world as trivialized, which means the following. That when you believe that God is beyond and you're always searching to go beyond the world to find God, that trivializes what you have in this world. You say, it's not important to have a car, it's not important to have a pool, it's not important my house, but also my wife's not important, my kids are not important, and actually my life is not important because what's important is God who's so far and I'm searching for God, and everything in this world becomes meaningless. And the world becomes just a corridor to the other spiritual world. The soul has become so ascendant that the entire world, its material as well as its spiritual manifestations, appears to it as an imprisonment. I want to die already and go to God. This world is an imprisonment. It's gripping us in a choking atmosphere. Such men who believe like this, feel like this, seek what is beyond their reach, what in their condition does not appear to exist. To change the non-existent to an existent is even beyond the will to entertain. It is for this reason that there is often a weakening of the will as well as of other life forces among people whose inner disposition is directed towards the quest for God. Let me explain a few things. The truth is that it looks like Rav Kook just contradicted himself.
Sounds
just
very
like
Christian.
Say it again?
This again sounds very Christian.
Okay. Paragraph 1 said you need to center your life in God. Paragraph 2 said you can't center your life in God. That's what it said.
Unattainable.
It's unattainable, right? Paragraph said 1 said you need to be founded in God. You need to orient yourself towards God. You need to immerse yourself in God. And paragraph 2 said you can't do that. And if you
never can totally find
it. You never can totally find it. And if you aspire towards it, it weakens your will because it's just so wearisome to try to find something that's not here, that's so far away. It becomes futile. And this is a criticism, a deep criticism, of course, of God seekers. But what type of God seekers? The God seekers that seek God beyond. And he certainly is criticizing the monastic life, right? That says this whole world is nothing, and it's all in the beyond. So he criticizes. Say it again.
Same thing could be said about seeking perfection in anything. Could use that analogy.
Okay, but here it's really that it just doesn't exist in this world. So I want to emphasize again, he contradicted himself. And of course, this contradiction leaves us with nothing. Because he says that the only meaning of life is in God, and then he says, and there is no God here, it's all beyond, then what do you have? And the next paragraph gives us his solution.
Process.
Yeah, but it's a little bit more complicated. You're right. It is necessary to show how one may enter the palace by way of the gate, which is process. You have to begin. The gate is the divine dimension disclosed in the world, in all its phenomena of beauty and grandeur. I'm going to stop there for a second. The one word that's most important in the sentence I just read is a two-letter word. And the word is in. I'll read it again. The gate is the divine dimension disclosed in the world. What Rav Kook just did is he said, move from this model to this model. In this model, he says, you're stuck in an impossible paradox. Man has to be centered in God for meaning in life. However, You cannot be centered in God because God is transcendent and other and beyond. The solution, he says, is the word in. Not to search for the God who is beyond, to search for the God who is within. Which means not just a psychological switch, it is also a theological metamorphosis. And this metamorphosis is exactly what we've been talking about for the past 2 weeks. This metamorphosis is exactly the move from all the vessels of the tabernacle to the altar of the incense. It's exactly the move from all the vestments of the high priest to the tzitz. It's exactly the move from Baruch Atah to Hashem. And now we understand what Rav Kook said in the previous paragraph, that this searching for the God who is beyond leads to a weakening of the will, leads to a weariness. I didn't pronounce it right, right? Weariness.
Weariness.
Leads to make you spiritually weary. That's the same thing I said earlier, that fear of God creates a certain paralysis, that there's a loss of the sense of confidence of life. And Rav Kook says that's bad, and the solution again is the process, the movement from transcendence, understanding of transcendence, to an understanding of immanence, from an understanding that the main mode of connection to God is awe, to an understanding that the main mode should be love. So now we can read on. And I really am saying that what we're reading is an essay based upon the Hasidic materials we've seen for the past 2 weeks. The gate is the divine dimension disclosed in the world, in all its phenomena of beauty and grandeur as manifested in every living thing, in every insect, in every blooming plant and flower, in every nation and state, in the sea with its turbulent waves, in the panorama of the skies, in the talents of all creatures, in the thoughts of writers, the imagination of poets, and the ideas of thinkers, in the feelings of every sensitive spirit, and in the heroic deeds of every person of valor. The highest domain of divinity towards which we aspire, to be absorbed in it, to be included in its radiance, but which eludes our longing, descends for us into the world, into the world. You don't have to aspire to leave the world for it.
Descends, that word I stop on, descends of all things. I always thought it was, you know, rise to the occasion, rise towards God, rise towards heaven.
So you don't have to rise towards heaven because heaven envelopes, right? This is this model, envelopes us. It's entered into the world, not in a sense of descent literally from up to above, but just infusing from all directions. It comes towards you, descends for us into the world, and we encounter it and delight in its love and find peace in its tranquility. At times, moreover, we are privileged with a flash emanating from the higher radiance, from that higher light which transcends all thought, because in the model of panentheism, there's the God that's immanent within the world, the world's in God, but there's also much of God outside, there's still the transcendence is there, and in this model of searching for divinity within the world, sometimes you may have a flash emanating from the higher radiance, from the higher light which transcends all thought. The heavens open for us and we see a vision of God. But we know that that's only a temporary state. The flash will pass, we will descend to dwell once again, not inside the palace, but only in the courts of the Lord. But the courts are pretty good, because the courts are within. It's not something that you only have to aspire to go beyond to reach it. When the longing for the light reaches its highest point, it begins to draw a great profusion of light from the hidden radiance in our own soul, through which is revealed the great truth, that all the worlds with all that is in them only appear to us particular effulgences, which means particular sense of separate radiances,
But they are in truth, they're not separate radiances, they are in truth manifestations of the higher light, the one higher light. And seen in their essence, they make up one whole, a unitary manifestation in which is included all beauty, all light, all truth, and all good. It's all one, and we're all part of it. These manifestations continually emerge and develop. They show themselves increasingly as in truth individual expressions of the all good. They're individual expressions, but they're not particular. Again, particular means separate. They're all part of one, because it's all in God. The bounty that streams through all the good, that raises the soul to its highest, that on the one hand, and be careful with the language, shrinks for us the significance of the existential world, the physical as well as the spiritual, all its splendor and magnificence. That's on the one hand. That, he's flashing back now, summarizing, that's what we're progressing away from. That's the model of only transcendence. That's the model that shrinks the significance of the physical world because we're trying to go beyond it. That's on the one hand. This very bounty now means when you've moved to the new model of immanence, this very bounty now renews for us all the worlds and all creatures, endowing them with a new image, because everything is seen as part of God. And every sign of life stirs joy. And every good deed delights the heart. And every study, every discipline of study broadens the mind. It's all part of God. It's not a world that you have to go beyond to reach God, that God is within it. The narrow boundaries of all these no longer oppress the soul, which at once realizes that all these tiny sparks continually ascend and become integrated into the comprehensive unity of all life. That's the Ketoret. That's that connects heaven and earth. It's all connected. Any comments?
I had another association. I don't know if you've ever read The Pagan Rabbi. It's by Ostrinker? No. Who wrote The Pagan?
I don't.
Very famous. Cynthia Ozick.
Oh, yeah. She is famous. I agree.
Yes. And she wrote this amazing short story about this rabbi who got caught up in the beauty of the world. And that there, and I don't remember how it ends, and I wish I wasn't the only one who read it. It's something like it somehow drew him away from God. You know, and I'm wondering where she got that. I mean, it's a very much of a commentary on
something.
Jewish life and, you know, probably the wrongness of that idea. But
like Rav Kook is saying that it's not you have to go beyond that beauty to find God, but find it within. Yeah. Of course, just remember that these are beautiful ideas, they're important ideas, they could be relevant ideas, but I'm never trying to claim they are the only way of looking at life or of Judaism. This is actually pretty minority. Right? This is not main. So perhaps I'll just mention it at the end because Karen brought it up. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, the essence of life is in the turbulence. It's in the struggle between love and fear. It's in the oscillation. There is no final green pasture in the world. To be a full human being is to struggle. Rav Kook says, nothing doing. To be a full human being is to find the green pasture. And there is a green pasture. And the green pasture is in the movement and the progression, the progress from transcendence to immanence. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik would look in Rav Kook and say, the green pasture that you're offering is an illusion. It doesn't exist. Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik have fundamentally different intuitions of what the religious life is. So now you're seeing Rav Kook's vision, certainly a Hasidic vision, very different than the Lithuanian vision of Rav Soloveitchik.
But you think that, at least in this country, maybe in Israel too, that the Hasidic view is becoming much more widespread?
It's certainly true that Pop Hasidut is taking over the Jewish world. Rav Shlomo Korbach is the one who introduced the Meir Shiloach to America, and that I'm not calling Pop Hasidut, that's serious stuff. Chabad has taken over the Jewish world, and so many ideas of Chabad that are very deep in their core, they have been popularized, and now many people think that's mainstream Judaism. It really was only a very small Hasidic dynasty that's been so powerful and so successful in marketing its ideas. So if you take Chabad with the influence of Rav Shlomo Korbach and then the influence of Rabbi Nachman today, really there's a whole movement that's been going on that's really bringing Neo-Hasidut into the mainstream. Absolutely, absolutely true.
Perhaps Gershon Scholem was part of that too, in helping us to rediscover on the scholarly side.
That's
all of that,
very good.
You know,
And
it's not just Pop.
So I don't know if you guys know who Gershon Scholem was, right? He was the first Jewish academic to bring Hasidut in, to bring Kabbalah into the mainstream of Jewish academic research, and. And he really opened up the whole world of Kabbalah and mysticism to academic research, and that certainly has filtered out of academia in many different frameworks. So if you mention, I'll just say that one of my closest friends just recently got the job as the curator of the Gershom Scholem Library in Yerushalayim. They just got an email yesterday that they're having a celebration for the 30th anniversary of Gershom Scholem's death, and if you want to go to Jerusalem in March, participate in the celebration, I can show you the invitation.
Are you going?
No, I'll be here. Okay, so next week it's off, and then 2 weeks later we're beginning our course.
Okay. And if we're going to get anybody here in 2 weeks, we got to tell them about it.
Yeah.
So. Okay. I think